It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. We are still busy processing here news involving State Capitol pundit Bill Ballinger and Susan J. Demas of Inside Michigan Politics. That, of course, is the political newsletter that Bill Ballinger founded many years ago that Susan J. Demas runs today. Later in the hour, we expect to speak with either Susan or with Bill regarding Bill's rather controversial comments yesterday to the effect that the Flint water crisis is overblown. That apparently led to his what sounds like his dismissal from Inside Michigan Politics, but we are going to try to clarify all the ins and outs of that before the end of the hour. So we're still trying to process that. We expect to have one or the other on the program before we wrap up here today. Well, the gravity of the Flint water crisis made last evening's State of the State address from Governor Rick Snyder his most closely watched ever. In it, the governor apologized again for the situation and said he takes full responsibility for it. Other highlights: he said he would release all of his emails involving Flint from 2014 and 2015. He pledged $28 million of state money to resolve the situation, and he said that that wouldn't be the last appropriation. In closing, he said the people of Michigan should hold him responsible for the outcome. Several times, the governor sounded nervous and emotional, his voice faltering. To share their thoughts and responses to the address, we welcome two guests and a state capitol journalist. Representative Tim Grimal of Auburn Hills is the House Democratic leader from the 29th District. Welcome back, Tim.
Great to be on the show. Thanks for having me.
Representing the state's 98th House District, Republican Gary Glenn of Midland. Welcome, Gary.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And also here to offer questions for our guests, the Detroit News' Chad Livengood. Chad, welcome back.
Glad to be here, Mark.
And there is what Rick Snyder said, what he said, and how he said it last night. Both are very important. He was obligated, it seems, to sound contrite and apologetic, and a number of times he did. Let's listen to a bit of that.
To you, the people of Flint, I say tonight, as I have before, I am sorry and I will fix it. No citizen of this great state should endure this kind of catastrophe. Government failed you, federal, state, and local leaders, by breaking the trust you placed in us. I'm sorry most of all that I let you down. You deserve better. You deserve accountability. You deserve to know that the buck stops here with me.
Tim Grimal, let's talk about the tone that the governor struck as opposed to what he said. Not what he said, but how he said it. Did the Flint portion of the address have the appropriate tone overall?
Well, I think in terms of the tone, it had the appropriate tone, and certainly I'll take his apology at face value and assume that he's sorry. I think we need to see more in the way of concrete actions to really see his actions comport with his apology.
Gary Glenn, what do you think? Did he strike the right tone?
Well, I thought he did strike the right tone. I thought his apology was appropriate. He said the buck stops here. He's the governor. He's the chief executive officer. So the failures of some of the state agencies, he acknowledged, apologized. And, you know, it seems to me like he very clearly laid down the choice we have this morning even, is that we can continue to invest our time and effort in finding people to blame, or we can invest our time, I think, more appropriately in finding positive steps we can take to help the people of Flint.
But Representative Glenn, doesn't there need to be a real full accounting of who did what, especially when it comes to terms with the emergency manager who was in charge of the city when this decision to temporarily take water out of Flint River was made?
Yeah, I think there absolutely does. The governor has said he's going to release all of his emails. I think he presented a timeline, which you'll be able to look at and determine whether you think that's accurate or not. The Flint City Council voted 7-1 to make the change in the water system. The appointed state administrator was there involved as well, but you're going to have access to those records. But absolutely there ought to be an accounting, and I think the governor acknowledged that last night, apologized. The point is, from this day forward, are we going to waste time looking backwards, recounting who was to blame at the federal, state, or local level? or are we going to focus our efforts on taking the steps we need to make sure everybody in Flint is safe?
The Detroit Free Press's entire Sunday editorial, quite a few column inches, was about the importance of releasing the emails. The governor said last night that he would do this. Tim Grimmel, what do you take away from this willingness to release these emails?
Well, let me first say that there's no question that the most urgent task is for all of us to work together in a bipartisan way to solve this problem. But Chad's absolutely right that we also need to have a better understanding of how this happened so that we can avoid it happening in the future. Certainly getting the governor's emails is an important first step. But we need a full release and full disclosure of all the relevant documents here, not just the governor's personal emails that he himself was on, but all emails and correspondence from his administration and all documents that relate to the Flint water crisis.
What action steps do you think the governor's been taking right now in Flint? Do you think are insufficient? What are the shortcomings right now?
Well, I would say a few things. Number one is that while the governor has paid lip service to holding those responsible accountable, the reality is that the emergency manager who was in Flint at the time, who was primarily responsible for this, is still to this day the current emergency manager in the Detroit public school system. That raises very serious questions about whether the governor is serious about holding people accountable when he's continuing to allow them to run the Detroit public school system. Incidentally, it also raises serious questions about the governor's commitment to help the Detroit public school system succeed when he's allowing it to be run by the person primarily responsible for literally poisoning children in Flint.
Representative Glenn, do you have any thoughts about this, about Darnell Early being the DPS emergency manager? Should he remain in that position? A lot of people, including Ingrid Jacques, said that the Detroit News have called for him to be canned.
I think that's something that ought to be looked at, but I think it ought to be looked at in light of the kind of investigation or detailing of the record that you've said needs to occur. I think we've got the Attorney General, Bill Schuette, is conducting an investigation. I believe that's one of two investigations. So, Chad, between your reporter, your investigative reporting, and two, I think, investigations being done. Certainly that ought to be an open question.
State Rep. Gary Glenn of Midland is with us. State Rep. Tim Grimmel, who is also the House Minority Leader, is with us. And we're also joined by the Detroit News' Chad Livengood here reviewing last night's State of the State address. Much has been made of the communication that did and did not occur over the months. The governor got pretty forceful at one point about communication in the future. Let's listen to that.
For those whose mistakes contributed to this disaster, we are fully cooperating with investigations and will hold those individuals accountable. And let me be perfectly clear to all of state government. And in situations like this, they must come to my desk immediately. No delays, no excuses, period.
Tim Grimmel, any response to that particular comment? There's a lot of confusion over when the DEQ might have said this, when the EPA may have said that. He seems to be rededicating himself to clarifying the flow of information here.
It's quite clear that a lot of people in the administration dropped the ball. But by the governor's own admission, he knew of the seriousness of this by late September or early October. And yet it took him more than 3 months to declare an emergency. It took him over 3 months to call in the National Guard. That is very troubling. I mean, there was a delay directly on the part of the governor here. Chad had asked earlier what we'd like to see. And one of the things that I was disappointed we didn't get more details on last night is what we need to do in the medium term and long term to A, fix the pipes in Flint so that we can ultimately continue to deliver water in a traditional way with safe, clean drinking water. And B, make sure that we have a specific concrete plan to boost special education services and educational wraparound services for those children who have suffered brain damage and will likely suffer learning disabilities.
Something that didn't get mentioned in the State of the State last night was this deadly outbreak of Legionnaires' disease, which they do not know whether is connected to the tainted Flint River water, but it is 10 people have died in Genesee County over this period of time in 2014, 2015. And Governor Snyder just got wind of it last Monday, according to his staff. So this is part of what this question was aimed at, or this statement was aimed at state employees, that he needs to be brought aware of things, not six 12 months after the fact. Representative Glenn, in that context, do we need some new laws to, like, get better, quicker public notification when we have a disease outbreak like this?
Well, I think that certainly is a common sense observation, but I think the failure here was the failure to adequately enforce existing laws. The governor did fire the head of the State Department of Environmental Quality. I understand the problem originated with a pH factor, the chemical composition of the water. And there's also some indication the EPA failed in its oversight responsibility. The director of the federal EPA has not been fired. Nobody's asking for President Obama's resignation. He's not yet issued a statement saying he's responsible, that the buck stops with him for any failure on the part of the EPA. I just think we should invest our time in finding every possible positive step we can take. It was my intention personally, because I think in positions of elected leadership, you ought to set an example. I ended up, without expecting it, spending the last weekend in the hospital, but my intention otherwise was to be in Flint with the National Guard, because I'm a former member of the Michigan National Guard, and the Military and Veterans Affairs Committee may yet do this coming Friday, and to be there, set an example, and help hand out water and filters with the police and the National Guardsmen.
And that's very important. I and others are going to be there this Saturday as well. And so, Gary, if you want to join us, it would be great to have you there. We'll talk off air about that. But okay. It's very important for all of us in a bipartisan way to roll up our sleeves, get to work, and solve the problem.
The governor alluded to this last night. Apparently, they've launched a website. Is it helpflint.org? I'm pretty sure that is the name
Help
of the
for Flint, I believe.
Help for Flint. It is something very much like that. It shouldn't be that hard to find in an effort to try to generate this kind of support. Tim Grimmel, you attend the Quadrant meetings regularly. You must feel at this point that you know Rick Snyder to some extent. When he says he pledges to working on the Flint water crisis for the rest of his term and resolving it, do you believe him or do you hesitate?
Well, I think at this point he will be doing that. But again, he knew about the severity of this, even by his own admission, going back almost 4 months now. And he really did not have any sense of urgency until the past few weeks when the media attention really focused on this issue. So
now that it's there, what do you expect?
Now that the media is focused on it and now that his feet are being held to the fire, yes, I think he'll be focused on it.
Representative Grimmel, do you think either the regional EPA director who has admitted that they knew back into April and raised concerns and did not and stayed quiet essentially while DEQ went about its business, either that person or the head of the EPA, where they should be fired over this?
Well, I've been very clear that government officials who are responsible for this disaster at all levels, whether it's local, state, or federal, need to be held accountable. Obviously, I'm a state official, and as state officials, we need to acknowledge the state's central role in this and make sure that we're doing what we need to do as a state to address this disaster.
Will the governor's performance last night, Representative Glenn, can the governor expect a break in the calls to resign, or do you expect a persistent call for the governor to resign, or will that hinge on his ability to address this issue the way he wants to address this issue?
You know, Governor Snyder is not an ideologue. He sees himself as a manager. I think he is mortified by this situation. But I think any call for him to resign is a non-starter. He's not going to be a quitter. He's going to stay on the job and do what he said he was going to do with the promise he made last night. And it makes no more sense than for me to sit here and waste our time calling on President Obama to resign, because the buck stops with him for any action by the federal EPA. That's a waste of time. We ought to focus on positive action. Tim is talking about working together on a bipartisan fashion. I 100% agree. This is not a partisan issue. It shouldn't be used as a political football for political points. If we focus on the solution, Tim and I are going to be standing next to each other sometime this weekend handing out water in Flint.
Tim Grimmel, how do you respond to critics who say the governor should resign?
Well, I think there are a lot of open questions right now about exactly what the timeline is, what the governor knew, and when did he know it. You know, I do think that if, in fact, he knew about this earlier than he suggested and that he did not take prompt, responsible action, then yes, he should resign. But I don't think we know if that's the case yet. And certainly the highest priority is to work together to solve this crisis in Flint.
Representative Glenn, do you see the legislature taking swift action on these funding requests from the governor? And also, Representative Al Pashoka, has the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee, has suggested there isn't a blank check here available. Yeah. How do you see the legislature scrutinizing these funding requests and needs for Flint?
Well, first of all, we do have the benefit of a roughly estimated $500 million surplus in the current budget year that was not anticipated. You know, the governor talked about some things other than just Flint. One of them was the fact that Michigan is now number one in the nation in new manufacturing job growth, that from 2013 to 2014, that income growth in Michigan more than doubled. We're an economic success story and turnaround story. So that gives us $500 million as a potential surplus. And I believe the first ask is for what seems like a fairly modest $22 million. I would expect fairly quick action on that. What comes after that, we'll have to look at it each step of the way.
Should the state pay for the water bills of Flint residents from April of 2014 till to date for water that they either can't drink now or essentially were drinking to the potential poisoning of themselves?
Well, I think that's an open question because the state ought to be looked at as perhaps potentially culpable. But you also, if I heard your comment a few minutes ago, Chad, you said that the federal EPA knew about this some months earlier than the governor says he knew about it. So then the question would be open, should the federal government play some role of responsibility? The governor has asked for a disaster declaration, which was initially turned down. I understand he's going to appeal that and ask for an enhancement of the federal declaration, which means more federal money would be involved. So if the EPA knew first, before the governor, who is it that should be resigning? Who should be first in line to be helping the people of Flint with their water bills?
Republican Representative Gary Glenn of Midland, Representative Tim Grimmel is also with us, and Chad Livengood of the Detroit News. We'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the governor's comments involving the Detroit public schools, its challenges. For my money, this was harder to parse out exactly what he was saying than it was in the Flint section of his address. He seemed to emphasize that the rest of the state is making progress, in his view, in education, and the priority seemed to be identifying why Detroit and other districts are not a part of this broader turnaround. He's appointing a commission to try to find out why. It will look at, quote, the obstacles that are holding us back. Tim Grimmel, what do you make? How did you parse the governor's comments regarding the Detroit public schools?
Well, I was glad to hear the governor acknowledge a couple of things in the speech. He acknowledged that even as our economy is growing, many, many residents are being left behind in that economic prosperity. And he also acknowledged the importance of education. Unfortunately, that rhetoric has not matched the administration's policies. It has not matched the legislative Republican majority's policies. We know that the key to being successful economically in the 21st century is investing in education at all levels, from pre-K through high school and at the higher education level. And we've got to do more to make higher education, colleges, universities, trade schools affordable to all Michiganders.
Representative Glenn, last night when the governor was talking about Detroit public schools, he renewed his call for the legislature to include in this reform of DPS the creation of a new Detroit Education Commission that would have the power to regulate and open and close both DPS schools and charter schools that are academically failing. This is not in the Senate legislation. Why should the charter schools not be on the same playing field as DPS when it comes to academic oversight?
Well, I think the problem has not been with the charter schools in Detroit. If there are individual charter schools that have somehow been deficient, then we ought to be looking at them as individual institutions. What has been for decades deficient is the Detroit public schools. The state of Michigan, in terms of investment, I agree with Tim, but we had the record highest expenditure ever for public education in this year's budget. And Tim, I think the budget passed like, 95-10, the school budget? When's the last time a school budget in the Michigan House invested or passed with almost unanimous support from both parties? Highest ever. So the investment's been there. Our school system has been performing in other parts of the state. I think one of the deficiencies is, you know, we know that when, you know, every child, every parent in Detroit deserves the same access to a safe and quality education. But when parents don't have the freedom to choose what they think is the safe and best school for their child, they're not going to get the best product. We need to remove some of the barriers in our state constitution. It may be done by the U.S. Supreme Court in a case out of Colorado that would allow the state of Michigan to financially empower the poorest parent in Detroit to be able to make a choice to take their child and put them in the safest and the highest quality public school, non-public school, parochial school, Christian or charter school. Put the parents in charge and financially empower even the lowest income parent, and then we're going to get a better product for the price we invest.
Tim Grimmel.
I was just going to say that the reality is that per student funding for local public schools across the state has not kept pace with inflation. So in terms of inflation-adjusted dollars, per student funding in Michigan is still substantially below where it's been historically. And that's especially true at the higher education level, where even in absolute terms, forget about inflation adjusted, in absolute terms, we are spending far fewer resources on higher education today than we were 5 years ago when Republicans came to majority in the House and Senate and when the governor was elected. And how have colleges and universities made up for that absence of state funding? By raising tuition. We need to cap tuition and make sure that college is affordable for everyone, while at the same time increasing funding from the state so that universities and colleges can succeed.
But Representative Grimmel, turning back to Detroit Public Schools in this current debate, are Democrats going to walk away from this if they don't get some type of reining in a regulation of charter schools in Detroit?
Well, I think the governor has made the case, and I think other advocates for the Detroit public school system on both sides of the aisle have made the case very clearly that unless we better coordinate the location of charter schools, the location of public traditional public schools, transportation between the two, that we're going to consistently see a waste of resources as schools open right next to each other, a continued siphoning of students away from the Detroit public school system. And ultimately, if we don't address that through this Detroit Education Commission or some similar entity, we're going to see the Detroit public school system right back in the same situation it is now, 5 or 10 years down the line. And so I do think that some better coordination and management has to occur.
Well, we have to wrap with Representative Glenn. I want to ask you, what is the attitude in the House right now, in your view, toward addressing the district's debt? It's about $500 million in debt. What is the sentiment toward Lansing helping out DPS with that debt?
Well, I think the sentiment of the legislature representing their own constituents is that our constituents are not of a mind to once again be asked to take dollars out of the classrooms in Midland and Bay counties, for example, and send them to Detroit. But we do face the hard budget reality that if a judge gets involved and the Detroit public schools do in fact go bankrupt, we could see the liability to the taxpayers of Michigan double. So it may be that you have to spend a whole lot more than you want to now to avoid having to spend double that sometime later if it goes to court. So it's a tough situation to be in. Everybody wishes that we could. I think the ultimate solution to making sure the dollars are spent most effectively in delivering the education product is to put parents in charge of their children's education.
We will leave it there. We want to thank our guest. Gary Glenn is the Republican state representative from the 98th House District in Midland. Tim Grimmel, thank you for joining. It's been a busy day for you in particular.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
The media, it is always, you're always welcome here. Ditto Chad Livengood of the Detroit News. Thank you for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR, I'm Mark Bayshore. It has been a difficult time for music fans who came of age in the 1970s this week. In just over a week, the music world lost rocker David Bowie and Glenn Frey. Frey was co-founder of the Eagles, the band which brought a darker, more reflective mood to the California sound once pioneered by the Beach Boys. But Glenn Frey was a Michigander, and current state's Kevin Lavery is here to tell us more about his early days in Metro Detroit. I know he's a Royal Oak Dondero High School graduate, Kevin.
That's exactly right. In fact, we're going to be hearing a mention of his school here in just a moment. Glenn Frey was born in Detroit, as you say, grew up in Royal Oak. He was good friends with Bob Seger. The two of them collaborated on each other's work. So I spoke with Susan Whitehall about this. She's a music journalist and an author, formerly with the Detroit News. She says the guy who loved soul, country, and rock started off learning the classics.
Glenn, he came from a, you know, modest middle-class background, but he was taking classical piano lessons from an early age, from the age of six. And you don't really think of him in that terms, at least I didn't. But he really was the backbone of the Eagles in terms of as an arranger because of that early classical piano background.
I would have never taken Glenn Frey as a classical pianist.
That's just the thing. He was able to take the raw bones of a song and really arrange it into something. That was just one of his great skills that he brought to the Eagles. And in Desperado, you know, those chords, those are Glenn. That was Glenn's classical piano background that you can hear in that.
It's an understatement, Susan, to say that the Eagles captured the mood and the essence of the 70s. I mean, you know, the sense of despair and decadence of Southern California life in the 70s. But also, Glenn Frey was right there with love songs, even love songs about betrayal. I'm thinking about Lion Eyes. I mean, there was just a real blend of the emotional and the cynical that came from Glenn Frey's work.
Really, there was. They were so deeply embedded in that whole California mythology. The underside of it as well as the beautiful side. City girls just seem to find
out early. We're talking with music author and journalist Susan Whitehall, formerly of the Detroit News, now a contributor to the paper, about the Detroit roots of the late Glenn Frey of the Eagles. I'm assuming, Susan, that you met Glenn Frey at one point or another in your career. Any personal stories about him?
Yeah, actually, I got to go out to Los Angeles in 1994, and I talked to the men. In fact, we went back and dug up my interview with the guys for the Detroit News story. And at that point, the Eagles had gotten back together after some years of great turmoil. He and Don Henley were great partners, but they also, like any family or marriage, they had their issues, and they were a bit of a dysfunctional family. And Glenn was talking a lot about how it was like a marriage, and it was like any relationship, that they were, it didn't mean they weren't close and they didn't really respect each other, but they had problems dealing with each other. So he was always a little edgier and a little, in a good way, a little more energetic than Don Henley, who had that kind of laid-back Texas thing going on. And Glenn never forgot Detroit. He was always interested in talking about Detroit. I remember one time I was talking to him about going to Royal Oak Dondero High School, and it's right by the railroad tracks, kind of. And he was reminiscing about meeting girlfriends out by the railroad tracks. She wasn't just another one. And I couldn't keep from coming on. From what I hear from girls who were going to school at that time with him, he was quite a good-looking guy, and he had quite a few girlfriends, and we were very happy to meet him wherever he wanted to go.
Sure. You know, I wonder if some of those experiences worked their way, even subtle ways, into his lyrics. Now, we'll probably never know.
Oh, absolutely, it did. So funny how those guys, it's always through a girlfriend they met each other. He met Bob Seger through a girlfriend. Their girlfriends were friends. And then he met J.D. Souther, who was also a native Detroiter, through their girlfriends who were sisters. So it's like you had to follow the girlfriends and you can kind of follow the narrative of their stories.
Who would have known that Detroit, a place known for Motown, a place known for punk, would have produced someone who was a giant in country rock, and not just country rock, a West Coast high lifestyle LA country rock kind of hybrid.
And yeah, as Seger was telling me, he loved soul music, and that's kind of what he brought to the Eagles. That not only did they call him the Lone Arranger because he arranged so beautifully, but he loved Marvin Gaye, Al Green. He loved Otis Redding so much, he named his youngest child Otis. So he was very much a Detroit guy in that way.
Susan, what kind of a following do you feel the Eagles still have today? They broke up 35-some years ago. What's really the appeal for younger generations? And do you think there are musicians now who have subscribed to the Glenn Frey School of Songwriting?
I think maybe they will. I mean, one good thing about when someone dies like this, and it's happened with David Bowie over the past week, is people start to listen to the music again very intensely. And people who maybe didn't listen to the music before or dismissed it, oh, those guys are just, you know, cocky California guys. But they'll hear it more now, and they'll listen, and they'll realize that there was a lot of complexity to that music. And they were very, very strong songwriters. You know, Bob Seger said that one of the things that reasons he hit it off with Glenn was they both realized how important songwriting was. They just couldn't make it as pop stars. They had to write their own material. And that backbone of musicianship is something that people might not realize about Fry, and they really should. They should look back at that. So, you know, for someone to hear Desperado for the first time, it's a great thing. I can't imagine anyone of any age not appreciating that song.
I kind of hate to say this because it's cliche, but it really seems to fit my mood, at least, as an Eagles fan. Heaven Has a New Kid in Town.
Yeah, yeah. There's been a lot of plays on Eagles songs. You know, Heartache Tonight and all that. And it's a shame. It's, you know, he had struggled with rheumatoid arthritis and was taking something for it and to alleviate it, and that kind of led to other problems. And this is 67 these days, just sounds a little too young. And that's, it was a little too unexpected and a little too quick. I know he had a lot of creativity left in him, and hopefully the rest, you know, these other guys are taking good care of themselves, and, you know, the rock death will slow down a little bit.
I hope so. I wasn't done mourning David Bowie yet.
Oh, I know. I know.
Susan Whitehall is a music journalist and author, a contributor to the Detroit News. We've been talking about the passing of Glenn Frey, co-founder of the Eagles, the iconic band from the 70s, who was raised in the Detroit area. Susan, thank you so much for your recollections of Glenn Frey.
Thank you. Glad to do it.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Labrie.
You look in her eyes, the music begins.
And coming up on Current State, Bill Ballinger on the WKAR-TV broadcast of the State of the State address last night opined that the severity of the problem in Flint has been exaggerated, and there have been reports that those comments have led to his dismissal from the political newsletter that he founded, Inside Michigan Politics. We'll clarify the situation coming up later this hour with Susan Demas, the current owner of Inside Michigan Politics. That and more on the way on Current State. Current State, three times daily on 90.5 WKAR and AM 870 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. For those of us who have it, the ability to read probably isn't something we always remember to appreciate. But when we stop to consider the challenges faced by a child who isn't exposed to books, an adult who never learned to read, or a person of any age who has to learn English as a second language, we realize how valuable literacy is. The Capital Area Literacy Coalition is a local nonprofit that helps individuals meet those challenges and become self-sufficient readers, writers, and speakers. For Neighbors in Action today, we're checking back in with them 2 years after they were last on Current State because they're working all the time. Here to talk with us are Executive Director Dr. Lois Bader and Volunteer Colonel John Lesk. Welcome back.
Thank you so much.
It's good to be here.
Lois, the Capital Area Literacy Coalition has a wide variety of programs to meet all kinds of needs. Can you give us a little overview of what you do?
Delighted. We have a program for children, many of them, or most of them actually, in the Lansing schools, who are living in poverty and struggling every day And so our Read to Succeed program, last semester we had 150 tutors that were trained in the most current and updated reading exercises and methods. And they're tutored one-on-one for a semester. And then some, if they need more tutoring, will continue a second semester and maybe a third. In 2 months, we had about 80 children gain were on grade level or above in reading. So that's been a very successful program and one that's desperately needed.
And you track their progress then
pretty
closely.
We pre and post test absolutely every semester. And all of our services are free.
John, you've been a volunteer with the organization for some time. What type of volunteering have you done exactly? Are you part of the Read to Succeed initiative?
No, I'm not. I taught GED and English as a second language, and had some quite singular successes there.
And what do you enjoy about it?
Well, watching somebody grow from not being able to speak and write the English language very well, and therefore not being very employable, to becoming a good tax-paying citizen and part of society. And then that bond of trust that we've built with that person and our society is immeasurable, quite a bridge, a bonding, if you will, with that person. And it's exponential in that person's relations with the people around them, or her and their siblings and children.
It's a game changer, I'm sure. Lois, you were on the program 2 years ago. Talk to us about the last couple of years in the Capital Area Literacy Coalition. Since your last visit, what's new? What if you were to give a 2-year report here, what would be at the top?
Right. Well, we've been doing very, very well in basic literacy. We still have a large number of people coming in who sort of turned themselves in, as they said, because they've been really struggling. We've been very successful for them. And the English as a Second Language program is, as John said, it's wonderful to see our refugees and migrants and work with people from different countries. They're from South America, from the Middle East, from Asia. And they're fun to work with. One of our women was walking down the hallway the other day, and she said to me, "Why do people say, 'How are you,' when they don't want to know?" And so it's kind of fun to deal with these people with an English language.
Welcome to America, where we ask you how you are, even if we don't want to know the answer.
That's right. And then we have... We collect a huge amount of books that are donated to us, and many of them from the wealthier districts. But sometimes we do have to purchase books too, especially for children who are primer, first grade level.
John, I understand you took your volunteer skills and put them to use in Afghanistan. Tell us about that.
Yes, I was in Afghanistan for a year and 10 days with a mission to help build their security forces. And we were having a start-stop effort there with them initially. And then I had some time and I sat down with the key leaders of the Afghanistan organization we were working with, these senior police officers. And I said, you know, I can help you learn English as well. And you know, in some of our downtime, as well as teaching them logistics and navigation and strategy, tactics, and stuff.
Which branch of the service are you
Army.
Are you in? Army.
Retired.
Okay.
And so it took days to set up an operation and to teach it and follow through and everything, it really broke down a lot of the walls and resistance there, because that they saw me as a person they could trust after those events, those tutoring events with them, that I was willing to give with those guys. I went over to some of their houses, met their families, these Afghanistan officers mm-hmm. we were working with. And it really helped out, I think, our mission. And I brought everybody, all of my guys home with all their fingers and toes as well, too.
Well done. Colonel John Lesk is a volunteer with the Capital Area Literacy Coalition. Dr. Lois Bader is the Literacy Coalition's executive director. Lois, the 2010 census showed that about 20% of adults in the greater Lansing area are illiterate. What are the causes of adult illiteracy?
The major cause is poverty. It doesn't matter whether people are inner city or rural. If they're living in poverty, they're likely to be illiterate. There are some exceptions, of course, but not that many, because in the case of the children's parents that we're working with, we'll have a single mother working two minimum wage jobs. She has little time or energy or even access to books to read to her child. And there's nothing more important in getting a child ready to learn than to reading to him. And so for part of our population who are affluent, reading is a regular ritual. They'll read books to children. I read to my own three children, and I knew that nothing helped them more than being read to and have their language development.
You must have worked with so many people over the years. Is there a most memorable encounter with anyone that you've worked with at the Literacy Coalition?
One man I was very impressed with had been put in foster care when he was three. By the time he was 16 and dropped out of school, he had been in 10 foster homes. He came in to get his GED. He worked very, very hard, but we were impressed with how quickly he learned. He must have been very bright. And so I really get concerned that we're going to cross off people who are poor and struggling, and we're losing people who really are quite intelligent and need to be welcomed into society.
John, what do you think makes an effective volunteer for literacy or English as a second language? Who's a good fit for this kind of volunteer work?
Just about anybody. And we have at our headquarters there at the Reading People, people that can set up you with the perfect match. And sometimes there's some that you don't match up. Well, we'll get you somebody that can match up, that you click with, so to speak.
Do you need volunteers right now, Lois?
Oh, we always need volunteers.
Are there always more people who want to be tutored than you have volunteers for?
Always, yes. Mm-hmm. Mm.
What led you and others here to create the Capital Area Literacy Coalition? Am I correct? You were a founder of the organization?
Well, yes. One of my doctoral students at Michigan State University said, they're starting up a literacy organization and you should get involved. And so I went down to be temporarily involved more than 30 years ago.
Well, we want to thank both of our guests. We've been speaking with Capital Area Literacy Coalition Executive Director Dr. Lois Bader, along with volunteer Colonel John Lesk. For people who want to learn more, Lois, your web address or phone number?
It's thereadingpeople.org.
Thereadingpeople.org.
That's right.
Hopefully we'll generate a volunteer or two with this encounter on Current State.
Thank you so much.
Nice to see you. Dr. Lois Bader, Colonel John Lesk, thanks for being with us. And Current State is always looking for more nominations for our Neighbors in Action feature. Please help us out. Email us your suggestions to currentstate@wkar.org. Please put Neighbors in Action in the subject line or tweet us at KAR Current State and tell us a little bit about why you think they should be featured. .5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. You're listening to Current State. Bill Ballinger, the longtime political pundit here, was on the WKAR TV broadcast of the State of the State address last night and opined that the severity of the problem in Flint has been exaggerated. Here's what he said.
The situation in Flint is nowhere near as bad as you are depicting. You have no idea what's going on in Flint. I was born and brought up there. I know what's going on.
And you live there now.
I live there.
But you've never had brown water.
Absolutely
not. So what did you think?
No elevated blood levels.
So what did you think when you heard that children and other families in your town did have brown water?
You know what? I've never seen any evidence that they do.
And those comments have apparently jeopardized Bill Ballinger's position with the political newsletter that he founded many years ago, Inside Michigan Politics. A lot of this unfolded here early this morning, and we've got Susan Demas, who's the current owner of Inside Michigan Politics, on the other end of our line to help us understand what's going on here. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Mark.
Could you clarify here for us here what is Bill Ballinger's status with Inside Michigan Politics right now?
Bill is no longer associated with Inside Michigan Politics in any way, shape, or form as of this morning. As you know, Mark, we talked back in October of 2013 when I bought Inside Michigan Politics, and since then, Bill has periodically contributed to IMP. That will no longer be the case. I find his comments last night to be indefensible, to be in direct violation of scientific fact, and I do not want them associated with my publication.
How much did you discuss his comments with him before ending this relationship?
Bill and I actually had a conversation yesterday following a radio interview he had done in Detroit, where he was just speaking as an analyst and as a Flint resident. But I told him that, you know, I set the editorial tone for IMP. I don't want him speaking on this issue in the future. I felt we had an understanding. And then, as you know, things exploded after the State of the State address when he was on Tim Skubick's program.
Well, they were surprising comments, I think, in particular because of the scientific work that has been done on the water in Flint. You do have did you ask him about the importance of the Virginia Tech study and the work of Dr. Mona Hanna Atisha? Did he respond to that to those studies?
I have not had an in-depth policy discussion with Bill. And so I do not know what his opinion on that is. My bottom line is I believe very much in taking an evidence-based approach to journalism. This violates that standard, and so I can no longer have somebody who doesn't follow that protocol associated with my publication.
We'll point out to our listeners that we did try to establish contact with Bill Ballinger here not too long ago, and we were unable to do so here. Bill Ballinger founded Inside Michigan Politics, Susan. Did you hesitate at all about this?
You know, to be honest, this is a human decision, and I consider Bill to be a friend. He is an encyclopedia of Michigan political knowledge. Yes, I did, but I felt it was very important to take swift action this morning, because I think his comments have brought great pain to the citizens of Flint and have done a disservice to, the scientific facts, that should not be disputed at all as we're moving forward and trying to help people.
How did he respond to your action?
Bill and I had a brief discussion this morning. He understands where I'm coming from, I would not describe us as having a relationship with any animosity. I find it incredibly unfortunate. I've enjoyed his contributions over the years when I've agreed with him, when I haven't, but there are lines in the sand, and this is one of them.
Let's move on. I would like to get your thoughts here with regard to the governor's comments involving Flint last night. It was an extraordinary State of the State address, one where the likes of which we're not apt to see, I think, probably for a number of years. It was an extraordinary evening. What did you make of the governor's comments involving Flint and the actions that he wants to take and his culpability in this?
Well, the governor was more emotional than I believe we've ever seen him. He's clearly very sorry about what has transpired. I do think that he did try and shift the blame too much. I would have liked to have seen a more statesmanlike approach. And he did outline a clear plan going forward. My concern is that the $28 million that he's asking for, I fear will just be a drop in the bucket as to what's needed to fully treat this health crisis. And as you know, even though we have a budget surplus of about $500 million, we may not be able to come up with the necessary money on our own. And, you know, certainly the people of Flint deserve no less.
Susan J. Demas is the owner and publisher of Inside Michigan Politics. Thank you, Susan.
Thank you.
And that's our program for today. Coming up on Thursday, fiber internet isn't just the fastest form of internet. It's also one of the fastest ways to bring technological advancement to a city. The Detroit company Rocket Fiber is bringing high-speed fiber internet to the Motor City. We'll talk with the co-founder and CEO, Mark Hudson, about his hopes for high-speed internet and what it could do for Detroit redevelopment. Plus, more than 40 years and hundreds of recordings later, MSU professor of violin Walter Verdaere is as busy as ever. Current State's Peter Wharf talks with the acclaimed violinist about his long, illustrious career ahead of a concert at the Cook Recital Hall on MSU's campus tomorrow evening. Peter Wharf is the executive producer of Current State. We want to thank April Van Buren, who directed our show today. Thanks as well to Scott Pohl, Katie Cook, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, and to Drew Hill. Don't forget, we're on Twitter at KAR Current State. We're on Facebook at Current State from WKAR. We hope to see you Thursday. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us.